Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric 13, and I am here with Austin background movie star, Michael Kester.
Thank you.
Welcome to the big time.
Had you started a little earlier, you could have said background, and I would have started speaking before we even began recording.
That's good. Yeah, you got that whole thing down now. You got it all down.
But I wouldn't have said anything. I would have been in full pantomime. Whispering is worse than talking.
Yeah, I talked through all of my stuff. I just ruin everything. What are we doing here on the show today? This is double feature. I assume we're doing two movies.
That's correct. In fact, these two movies are part of a larger scope project, which is the journey for this year, where we explore New York City through the eyes of two different directors, Woody Allen and Spike Lee.
New York City, the last state that neither of us have lived.
That's correct.
I don't know. Also, New York City, not a state. That would be New York. See, we don't know anything about it. Yeah, we're going to talk about Hannah and Her Sisters, and we're going to talk about the Spike Lee film, Crooklyn.
That's correct.
I guess I should mention the other one's Woody Allen. I don't want to give preferential treatment to a director here. And we're going to talk about why they're worth talking about, and we're going to do that right at the fucking top. So if you don't care about that, you just really want to hear a conversation about Crooklyn, you can use the chapters. Do be aware that we're going to spoil Crooklyn, and we're going to spoil Hannah and Her Sisters, which is going to come first. Everybody knows about the Woody Allen Spike Lee journey.
Yep.
Or they don't know what double feature is and found the show on accident or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to assume that they knew we did some other movies. You have mentioned a lot of reasons to me that you think this is a particularly notable pairing of two films.
Yeah, there's a ton.
Right after last time that we did one of these and you said this is the quintessential one of these.
Right.
Now we have another one that is highly notable.
Yeah, I think these two movies have a lot in common. One is that it's the first step for the journey where neither director is starring in their films, whereas previously, I mean, maybe not the main character, but certainly in the main cast. In this film, Woody Allen and Spike Lee take a backseat to characters who... well, in some cases are basically just them, and in other cases are young black girls.
Right.
And then it's also interesting because Woody Allen, having been a filmmaker so much longer than Spike Lee, we're finally catching up to the New York City that Spike Lee has showed us for three films.
Sure.
So we're finally kind of getting a context for Woody Allen's New York around the time of Spike Lee's Brooklyn, which I think is a really interesting lens, and all of it will be covered very in-depth after I tell you about our friend Hallie Blievsky.
Yes.
She helped us out with our Kickstarter, which is the only reason that this show can even happen. And she wanted me to tell you about Max 650, which is an art space.
I already know about it. I know all about it, but you can tell everybody else.
It's a residential artist community that brings visual arts and performance to Middletown, Connecticut. You can check it out and look at everything that they've got going on at max650.com. That's M-A-C, then numbers 650.com. And you can check out Hallie's stuff and the whole art space. And so thank you, Hallie. And without further ado, let's move to Uptown New York City. It might not be Uptown. I don't fucking know.
From Middletown, Connecticut.
Yeah,
there we go. Which is where we did what? Year three of the show was Middletown, Connecticut?
I believe so, yeah. I was in the bayou using tinfoil.
Oh, that's right. Have you been to... I don't think I've actually been to Connecticut either.
I've been to Connecticut.
Nobody cares about this. Anyways, Hannah and Her Sisters. Holy fuck, look at this cast. Carrie Fisher.
Yeah, agreed.
These people are all going to a swell fucking party.
It's insane. So the thing that's great about every time a Woody Allen movie starts is the score happens and it's just some dude playing a piano better than me.
Right.
And I think to myself, this could be over black. I don't need to see anything.
Sure.
I mean, I feel like these Woody Allen scores that we've seen now three times in a row convey so much of the air of these films.
It's insane.
And to see Woody Allen waning as the main character which we talked about in Manhattan and in Annie Hall as just a huge means of propelling the idea of the film, the tone.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the score is picking up where he's slacking off on acting. That and him writing, him basically casting Michael Caine in the role he was bound to play, except Michael Caine called back.
Called back?
Called back and said he would be in the film.
Oh, right. Sorry. I was like, was that the end of a thought there?
It's all good.
Yeah, the music has this, it's simultaneously a bunch of class, and it's also a little, it's just a little common man. It's a mm-hmm. little bit, mm-hmm. you know, it's Woody Allen dressed up in a tux, you know what right. I mean? It's this guy who's just, he would almost be embarrassing to bring somewhere.
Right.
And at the same time, he just has this, maybe it's grown over time, but it is this air of class to it.
Right.
And the music really, I think it probably helps the classy part more than anything, but yeah, it does convey that.
And it's also really funny because when he ends up at that punk show later on, which they assume is punk music, but it's actually some form of new wave B-sides.
Right, right. I like how you don't even know what band that is. You just assume it's their B-sides.
It's New Wave B-sides by Group of Albatross.
No, it's that band from The Howling 2.
Right, that's right. But when he ends up there, it's really funny because that's so much more in line with the kind of music that I would normally, it's certainly the kind of show I would find myself at. And I instead just get uncomfortable and I go, this isn't where this movie should be. What is this movie doing here? This is weird. This right. is very strange. And why is she doing so much cocaine? What movie am I watching right now?
Sure.
You manage to find yourself so immersed in the tone and that style of New York City that when you get to the other obviously present parts of New York City, you know, we're in the 80s now, Candy Kids, we've done Party Monster on the show. That's going on,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
That's going on at the same time as this movie. So to have Woody Allen stuck in a club with Diane Wiest doing cocaine, it's so fucking weird.
Yeah.
And it's great watching him bounce around all these super intricate characters. These it's funny to look at
your Max von Sydows and your
right.
Is that fucking John Turturro?
Yeah. Right? Right
next
around the same
Woody
time.
Woody Allen.
Yeah.
And it sort of looks like maybe Louis Black in the background.
Maybe.
Am I crazy?
I don't know. I didn't catch that. I was too busy thinking about Sal's Famous Pizza.
How the fuck did John Turturro not age at all and Woody Allen looks as old as he does now?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Woody Allen aged 40 years and John Turturro aged about 4.5 years.
Right.
I don't know what the fuck happened there. yeah, that's some time defying right there.
Well, and it's funny looking at the whole cast at the top of the movie, and there's two notable things. One is that it's an absolutely shocking number of people I wouldn't expect to be in a Woody Allen movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that instead of them blending seamlessly in kind of an ensemble sort of dramatic comedy, none of them make any goddamn sense in a room with each other.
Right.
And that's kind of the point.
Why do these people know each other?
Right. Yeah. And it's great because the title gives it away. Well, that's what happens when you're family. You know, sisters don't have to yeah. be alike at all. And then they get to bring in all sorts of incongruous people.
Sure, sure, definitely.
But the other thing that I thought was super notable about this list is that Diane Keaton wasn't on it.
Yes.
We've seen Diane Keaton basically star in the first two films for the Woody Allen half of this journey. And I know they had a relationship. I don't know when they fell out. I'm assuming this has nothing to do with that. But it's really interesting because for me, Diane Keaton was kind of the Michael Myers of the Woody Allen movies at this point, where I'm going, oh man, she gonna come back for three? She gonna come back? Oh no, we get Silver Shamrock. We got Silver Shamrocked this time.
Right, that Michael Myers, not the third Austin Powers. Gotta be careful on that. Gotta be careful. Wrong franchise. All of the stuff that Woody Allen is toying with thematically in this movie is such a great evolution of what we've been seeing in his movies, right down to him as a, you know, a hypochondriac,
right,
which is new for the character he's playing, mm-hmm. but is not something out of what you
sure.
would.
It's not outside his range.
Yeah, it gives a new place for him to go and new kind of concerns and allows this really strange where the movie becomes a religious parody mm-hmm. for some amount of time, which is one of my favorite scenes. He's telling his parents that he's going to believe in Jesus.
Yeah.
Why would you do that? I know it sounds insane.
I liked when he was speaking to the priest and he goes, yeah, no, I really like your religion. I need you to help me believe in, because I don't believe in God, but I want to. Can you give me some sort of proof so that I can get into your religion here?
This is actually when I talked to Tyler from Battleship Retention.
Right.
That's basically basically what it is. I actually think in that same scene with his parents, there's an interesting thing that isn't, it's not completely overblown or drawn out, which is another thing that I'm starting to really like about Woody Allen movies, is they'll dance all over the place and just sort of leave the ideas behind. There, you can chew on that, and then I'm going to go over here. But his dad's talking about not being worried about dying, because obviously he'll be unconscious. How could he worry about it?
Right.
And that really is the argument, I guess. You know, we're both atheists.
Right.
We don't think there's a life after death. And in talking to other atheists about it, there's kind of this division of people who are terrified of dying and people who think you're insane for being terrified of it because you won't be around to care.
Right.
Why would you possibly, right. They can't understand how that would possibly get to you. The moment of him finding out that he doesn't have the brain tumor and then running out and seizing life is, I feel that way every day.
Yeah.
You know, that's constantly my life. Every day I wake up and I just go, fuck, life is so fleeting. It could end at any moment. I have to just go do something. I think you kind of had that after we watched Synecdoche, New York for this year's additional content.
Totally.
That moment of, why are we even podcasting?
I know.
What is this? How do I finish this movie? I need to go out and change the world.
It feels like a challenge. Whereas something like Hannah and her sisters, it doesn't feel... Do you ever get concerned that the character is going to have a brain tumor, or do you kind of just come out of the gate going, this guy's making a big deal out of this?
I don't know. I kind of go back and forth. It does surprise me the moment he has the imagined bad news.
Yeah.
And I guess I am kind of going, oh, I guess I just really didn't expect that to happen.
I mean, I don't know if it's the tone of the movie or because the character seems like such a hypochondriac or because I have had a ringing in my ear since I was 4 years old, but I just don't expect a brain tumor.
No one expects the brain tumor.
The thing that's kind of great about this movie is it follows what seems like an obvious blueprint for every character. The arcs of all the characters seem pretty predetermined as soon as you meet them.
You think so?
I think so. But just like when we did Annie Hall, it does that curveball where you start thinking, you know, Michael Caine's character is totally going to end up with this character.
Right.
And all the you start kind of seeing a blueprint for who's going to end up happy and who's going to end up spurned.
Sure.
And
I would argue the same of Manhattan, actually.
Yeah. And I think that that's something that's really interesting, because we're three Woody Allen, we're halfway through this journey, right? We're three films deep, and it still surprises me. I don't know if it's a mechanism that's just constantly going to work, or just something that I'm so not accustomed to seeing that I just can't, my brain isn't trained to expect that. But I think that it adds a certain depth to the characters, because I think Michael Caine's character in this acts the whole time like, I ask a question often in films, romantic comedies, where people are being dicks to their current significant other because in pursuit of truer happiness, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And then there's that moment where he goes, what the fuck? Listen, I can understand I won't be as happy with Hannah, but I can't just, I would destroy her, whereas I would mildly inconvenience this new girl.
Oh, sure.
And I go, yeah, correct. But part of me is going, you know, pursue your ultimate happiness. And the other part of me is going, exist as a species and not as an individual.
Right.
And then there's the trick-or-treat-esque option C. Oh, no, this is going to go badly for you. I just think it's really great because you see so often in romantic comedies, these characters that are basically assured that they're pursuing greater love and greater happiness, and that that is the ultimate, you know, that their pursuit in that is the truest form of them being true to themselves. And so often in the films, you forget that the other player is also a human being that needs to be true to themselves as opposed to Quarry. So often in you get this idea that the love interest that's been introduced slightly later in the way that the film has been written gets written as that's the person they're trying to get. And their opinion doesn't really matter because our main character has to change their mind.
Right.
Whereas that feels like a very predator-prey sort of dichotomy, when in reality, it's two predators searching for the remaining 7 billion of the world for the optimal prey.
I am terrible about this, though. For every conversation you and I have had about morality or ethics or which kid should you push off the boat, something that we haven't really talked about is I have this ethical blind spot in my mind when it comes to romantic entanglement.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why it's there, but I will often go through even great detriment to myself to make sure that, you know, things are balanced and right in the world.
Yeah.
That, you know, I'm doing the right humanistic thing, even if it's hurting me a little bit, just whatever, you know, whatever the right thing to do is.
So that would be an example of exist as a species and not as an individual.
Well, except when it comes to women. And I don't know why, but I just let them make their own mistakes and I just turn a blind eye to it. This idea in this movie of the story of being in love with the wrong person, sort of,
mm-hmm.
right? Why can't I just feel that? I hear those same excuses in my head all the time. Oh, I can't help who I'm in love with. It's just a thing that's happening. I guess I have to pursue it ultimately,
right?
And fuck over whatever, you know, other thing is happening in my life or in this person's life or whatever. And, you know, the way they have this setup where their relationship's kind of falling apart and then they go for the exact wrong person. I mean, the wife's best friend or the girlfriend's sister or the last person that you should be doing this with ever. And then that person kind of, yeah, I guess they fell for you too, but they're guilty and they don't want to. It's also this weird difference in the mindset of men and women, I think. And an area that I don't explore in my head a lot because as somebody who's for what at some point in our show is called feminism, I don't know what,
yeah, isn't
what
that anymore. Thing,
yeah. Yeah, I don't know what that word means anymore.
Yeah. That's bizarre to think about, to think 6 years ago we could have said that, yeah, we kind of feel good about feminism.
We could have easily just been as a feminist, you know, but I don't even.
And now it's weird. Now it's a whole weird thing.
Because we mention our Twitter handles at the end and we don't want to get blown up. That's the reason. But no, you know what I mean though, as a feminist or whatever, I don't like thinking there are differences between men and women, even though there clearly are. And I don't like lumping all of a gender.
Boys have a penis and girls have a vagina.
I don't like lumping all of a gender into a category and how they react to things.
Mm-hmm.
But I do find that there is...
Women to be crazy? Is that what you're going to say?
No,
that's the wrong
I was
going to
say
okay.
The idea of wanting to abstain from guilt a little bit or... Basically going, well, yeah, I feel that, but I'm not going to say that out loud to you.
Uh-huh.
Not even anecdotally, but just in how we see it represented in cinema. I mean, I don't even know if it's necessarily true, but from the vantage point of all the male writers in cinema, that seems to be an arc that shows up again and again.
Yeah.
And then when we see these two people outside talking and he's sort of luring her out of the relationship a little bit. And she's kind of like, yeah, I have these thoughts, but unlike you, I don't feel that I need to be compelled by them.
Right.
And then the immediate kind of hookup after that.
Right.
I don't know what these people should do. What do you think? You have a better,
well,
you know how to do this and I don't. What should these people do?
I operate the wrong way and the other way where, whatever that thing is, the romantic thing in a person, I totally have that. I can find that. I'm attracted to other people. I have that whole thing. But fundamentally, I'm the character. If I were a character in a film, I would be the kind of character that would get into a relationship, but right at the top kind of go, okay, but listen, I'm a musician and that is actually sure. what I'm dating.
Sure, right.
You know, and I don't mean solely music, but the sheer amount of creative endeavors that I have in my life supersede my basic human interaction. You're basically, you, Eric, are basically the exception to that because you are a large part of my creative output.
Right.
So our relationship gets to flourish on a level that most people's don't get to with me, because if you don't play an instrument and you're not in my band, there's just like a certain disadvantage to having you around.
Aha, take that, Michael's girlfriend.
And so for me, it's a lot. I think I fall on the other side of the two, where I go, yeah, I have those feelings, but you know, my priorities are in a different place.
Right, right.
And I can acknowledge chemical reactions versus like utter need. And I'm compelled. I'm not saying that I'm just not hopelessly romantic at times, but you know, it's not for long periods of time. I get more, you know, hungry to play more music or like make more shit
sure.
faster than I do to, you know, have a relationship like that a lot of the time. And so I think I'm the opposite of you, but I still feel like I'm in the wrong place, which I think is an interesting...
I still think maybe you're doing something unethical by toying yeah. with someone's emotions.
Well, yeah, I think that what it kind of, the portrait that we've painted is that in this scenario where Michael Caine is, you know, trying to balance what's going on and all these characters are kind of hung in different places, I don't think anybody's necessarily in the right. I don't think that you can know the right.
Yeah.
This is a totally backwards way to get here in this conversation, but I think that's kind of, I think there's a point in the film that's making a very, very common statement with this kind of thing that you and I have just discovered, which is when later in the film, the character that Woody Allen ends up with, he went on a date with, and that was the punk rock show that we already talked about.
Sure.
And it's kind of this idea that, you know, he wasn't ready at that time and she clearly wasn't the person she was then. And, but at the end of everything, that was the way that it worked out. And so it's interesting to say that, you know, nobody was right at that moment in time.
Yeah.
And to view, it's only right when it works. I think that can be easily misconstrued to mean if it's right, it will work. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The kind of faded, if it's meant to be, it'll be.
Right.
But that's not what I mean. I mean, if it's not right until it works, once it's working, it's clearly the right time.
Sure.
And I think that that's kind of, you know, there's definitely something to be said about growth, and also something interesting through the way that that Hannah and her sisters deals with it, and that you're basically plinkoing through the rungs of her family.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Only to basically go back and go, oh no, let's go back three levels sure. and we'll just stay there.
Sure. Well, and I think my adolescent awakening to this was getting on social media and finding there is a relationship status of it's complicated.
Mm-hmm.
It was my first
realization that that's the way to describe everybody's relationship.
Right, that everybody gets involved in things that don't make sense and aren't the portrait of American family and so forth. But still,
that's a Marilyn Manson record.
I noticed. Still, I was sneaking it on here. Why'd you have to blow my cover?
I'm sorry.
Listen, you can have your cake and sodomy it too. I didn't start thinking about how that sentence was going to end.
Oh man,
before
that
I said
joke
it.
Was the high end of the low.
Okay. I do. I just take great comfort in seeing things like this represented in art. Sometimes just knowing that it's not completely unique to you is enough. You know, that other people struggle with things like this or go through, you're in a fine relationship, I guess. Maybe it's stagnating, boring, something else crazy happens. You're drawn to somebody's fucking sister or whatever, or you just, whatever thing happens, a life thing happens, and you suddenly find that
you don't have a brain tumor.
You, well, that too, but the brain tumor thing for me is really a large part of what I think this movie is saying the whole time,
mm-hmm.
which is just fucking pursue things.
just do it.
Right, exactly. Just it's come on.
It's like that Butthole Surfers quote.
I don't know it.
It's better to regret something you did than something you didn't do.
Is that, I don't think that's originally a Butthole Surfers. I believe they may be.
As far as I'm concerned, it's a Butthole Surfers quote.
The philosopher Butthole Surfers once said, no, but I mean, the whole movie screams that. It says, don't let things get in your way, you know, seize the moment. No matter how fucked up or what people will think, just ignore it. Who cares? This movie does not give a fuck what other people are going to think of its actions.
Yeah, as long as you're not selling your artwork to Daniel Stern.
Well, have some standards, but, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about Woody Allen's personal life last episode, and this movie is yet another shining example, I think, of, you know what, life is hard and it's finite, and just find something that makes you happy, and if other people are happy with it too, fuck what everybody else in the world is going to think about your, you know, judging your non-conventional relationship.
It brings me back to that line from A Dirty Shame, which is basically my version of gospel, where Johnny Knoxville's character said, anything can be a fetish as long as it's safe, consensual, and doesn't harm other people.
Yeah, sure.
I feel like that can be extrapolated to just be a way to live.
Right, right.
You can live any way you want as long as it's safe, consensual, and doesn't harm other people.
And you can change your mind on it as often as, yeah, like Michael Caine's character in every fucking scene, which I love.
Of course, it's so clear now.
He goes, no, this is the way it is. I can't believe I didn't realize this. What am I going to, okay, I'm going to call her on the phone and I'm going to tell her. And then she calls and says, I just want to let you know I feel very close to you right now, and hangs up. And he goes, oh, well, fuck that, I guess.
Yeah.
That whole, man, that line is just like fucking swoon.
It's so good.
That I find to be romantic are so terribly, terribly wrong. It's just, I think my primary turn on is an absurd level of disaster. I think that's probably when I go, wow, this is going to be a train wreck. That's when I'm right in the zone.
Beat off to The Day After Tomorrow.
Right.
Just because not only is it a film about multiple disasters, but it is in itself a disaster.
I feel like you get the spirit, but not the letter of what I'm saying. Let's talk about Crooklyn.
Crooklyn. So I want to start with something that happens partially through Crooklyn and get your opinion on it.
Yeah.
How long did you try to find a better aspect ratio when she ends up at the other house? Give me ballpark how long that took you to accept that was the way it was supposed to be.
Oh my God. I did pause the movie. I tried to download again from iTunes. I looked it up online. I was like, does this use several aspect ratios? What's going on? There's, for people who didn't see Crooklyn and are just listening to this, because they don't care what happens in the movies, only what two assholes on the internet say about the movies.
Safe, consensual, and doesn't hurt other people.
Yeah. Why not, man? Why not? There's a 16:9 film called Crooklyn, and in it, there's a long, let's say, stretch of the film.
Yeah.
That is 2:35:1, but is stretched to 16:9. Apparently it's intentional.
Yeah.
There's nothing else I need to say about it. You know, when I felt like we were being too hard on Spike Lee and his racist Twitter account, last time on the show, then I saw this and I went, really, that's the effect you want to. Now, if you do like a soft focus to make it all dreamy.
Sure.
And it looks really tacky today.
Sure.
I mean, minus 1 point because you couldn't see into the future of this tacky effect.
Mm-hmm.
But if you somehow thought you could just fuck the aspect ratio and that would hold up over time, that's minus 10 points is what that is.
Yeah. That was definitely a stroke of not seeing the digital era coming, I think.
Certainly it was. Yeah. Somebody on an IMDb board attempted to explain that using a quote that he said about anamorphic. I don't even know what the word is because it never made fucking sense. No one ever understood.
Anamorphic widescreen.
Right. But it's when the movies, it doesn't even matter. I don't even care about it because we use digital now. It's a way better system. It doesn't involve constraining to a box, but stretching and then having your DVD player restretch it so it's in the what a stupid fucking system that was. Discs and lasers. Oh, so glad we're beyond that. Anyways, Crooklyn. it's So give me the breakdown on the years. Where are we in... This is also a portrait of New York for us.
Right. Hen and Her Sisters is from 1986, which is around the same time that She's Gotta Have It came out. Mm-hmm. So that's where the overlap has begun. And we'll get closer and closer as we go through this. So Crooklyn came out in 1994. So we're still kind of give or take 10 years off.
We're getting closer though.
Yeah, much closer. And the 90s are certainly notorious in big league cinema for our favorite Warriors-esque gangs.
Yeah.
In real dramas. Whereas in the 80s, they were just in Jason Takes Manhattan.
Sure.
And the Warriors. But in the 90s, they would dress Jeff Goldblum up like that.
Sure.
All the way into the 90s. Different Jeff Goldblums. So this is, it's definitely in a time, it's Clinton era. You know, there's financial struggle. It's definitely becoming, reality is definitely permeating the social view of New York City. Woody Allen's beautiful piano New York is slowly shedding, I think. I think we're getting more aware. You know how now when you mention New York City, someone who's been there always counters with, it's dirty, they don't have anywhere to put their trash?
No, but
I get that all the time.
Really?
Anytime I mention never being to New York City, I don't even say it in a negative way. I go, oh, I've never been to New York City. The response is always, it's dirty, they don't have alleys to put their trash in.
Sure.
And I say, that's fine. This is a movie that seems, I mean, Do the Right Thing definitely had the hot summer aspect of New York, but this is starting to feel like there's no alleys to put our trash, so let's throw them at Patrick Michael Kelly.
Right.
And it's also really interesting because Crooklyn, unlike the previous two Spike Lee films that we've covered, follows a nuclear family.
Mm-hmm.
People who are all raised and live in the same house.
Although you have an in-and-out dad,
right,
a little bit. So it's
kind of like a microcosm of Do the Right Thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where instead of the family being the greater Brooklyn block that Sal's is on, it's kind of, it's squished down to essentially the same amount of people. I mean, there's a ton of children, there's a few authority units, and we're trying to figure out the struggle of which authority unit is the right person to follow when we're too naive to know the difference.
Right.
Which is essentially what Do the Right Thing breaks down to.
Yeah, well, that movie spent a lot of time in neighborhoods talking mm-hmm. about the neighborhood and the community. And this movie is a lot more focused on something that we kind of ignored to serve the community story, which is what is the life like for individual people?
Mm-hmm.
We learned about Mookie a little bit and we kind of saw places he went, but I don't think we ever got a real sense of a full day in one of those characters' lives.
Right.
Who's closest to them and who their mortal enemy is
mm-hmm.
and what's important in their life.
Yeah.
Because it would have gotten in the way of servicing the story about the neighborhood.
Right.
Whereas this movie tells us a lot less about the neighborhood. We know the climate. We know that the economy is rough and we talk a lot about money,
mm-hmm.
but we talk about that in the family unit.
Mm-hmm.
We're following the people rather than the neighborhood. And they're still very much important to each other. We see the relationship with the shop on the corner and, you know, rather risk getting caught shoplifting than use food stamps.
Mm-hmm.
But even that is about the characters. It's not about food stamps in society. It's not about
exactly
what the, you know, we don't have a good picture of what the inside of that little corner store grocery place looks like. But we knew those neighborhoods. Well, we knew Sal's Pizzeria better than the characters that were in it.
Right.
It's near surreal actually going in that corner store and seeing the super tall blonde woman, the little Puerto Rican man,
mm-hmm.
almost in slow motion. I mean, this is more about character perception
right.
than it is about, you know, that's kind of a Twin Peaks moment
yeah.
for a Spike Lee movie. So I think I might disagree with you a little bit about this New York thing, and I want to keep getting into this. So you think that, I know we're definitely closer in time, and I will agree with you that their versions of New York are drawing more near.
Mm-hmm.
But you had mentioned to me before that you thought this was really the point where you're seeing a New York that is the same believable New York between the two movies.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't know if it's interesting to kind of examine it as whether or not it's cinematic climate or just general familiarity. For me, and I mean, I don't know about for you, but in our lifetime, mid-80s, these are basically the movies that we've seen without watching.
Mm-hmm.
Movies that have been on TV on Saturday our whole lives that we weren't watching, but we saw. And it really helped to sculpt New York City. And for me, it wasn't even until my more recent memory that I could identify Los Angeles in a movie.
Yeah.
Because of the sprawl of LA and the lack of general skyline and how huge it is and how the neighborhoods look so vastly different. New York City looks like New York City the whole way through.
Right.
I feel like it's way more common. I've actually had this conversation recently. I feel like it's way more common to shoot a film in Los Angeles and say you're filming it in St. Louis than it is to shoot a film in New York City and say you're not filming it in New York City.
Sure.
I feel like if you're filming, in reality, obviously you can shoot in New York City and call it fucking Gotham.
Right.
But I'm saying if you're shooting it in our universe, very rarely will somebody film in New York City and not say this is a film set in New York City.
Well, there's a lot that goes into that. One is that there's so many films made in LA that I think it has to be a lot of places. But you're right. There is a little bit of a chicken or the egg type scenario with LA of every mile or so is a completely different neighborhood. And then we just switch it up. We have a block that looks like a piece of New York.
Mm-hmm.
And then we do something completely different. And perhaps the movie industry helps perpetuate that because having all of these different neighborhoods helps you have different coverage for different things.
Production value, man.
Yeah, right. You can go places without actually going places. I don't know a lot about how LA is set up, but I was surprised to go there and find that all of these neighborhoods are, that LA is the second or third, I think, most populated city in the country, but it doesn't feel nearly as dense as Chicago or especially New York. I mean, nobody gets near the density of New York.
Right.
But because it's so spread out, it is so horizontal rather than stacked on top of itself the way somewhere like New York is.
Mm-hmm.
However, I also feel like we are starting to see the real class division in the Woody Allen New York and the Spike Lee New York. So maybe my disagreement there is more just that these do feel like very different neighborhoods we're in.
Right. But I feel like the cities are starting to be a lot more the same location.
Sure.
I just from living in an urban environment, I can kind of understand how you would get to Crooklyn from Hannah and her sisters, you know.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
There's a drivable route.
Sure.
Whereas I don't think I could tell you how to drive from the film Manhattan over to Do the Right Thing.
We're also seeing more diversity in what we're in the neighborhoods because in Hannah and her sisters, I know we're in a different chapter, so I'm not going to spoil anything here, but we talk about economic hardships a bit and we get a sense that different people might be living in different parts of the neighborhood, some better than others, right?
Yeah, for sure.
There's a little high society, there's a little bit lower society. We go on an architecture tour that I assume goes to a lot of these different places.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true in Crooklyn. We go down south.
Right.
So for the first time in our journey, we are taking a very real, very 2-3-5-1 departure to a completely different location.
Which
actually just serves to say more about New York.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's showing the contrast. So you're learning more by actually leaving the city and coming back.
Right.
Before we wrap, though, I did want to ask you, when we come back, there's the dark cancer turn. Jesus, what the fuck?
I know. That's something. So we talked about Woody Allen having his interesting kind of curve at the end of these romantic stories.
Mm-hmm.
So this is important to recant, but I've seen all of the Spike Lee movies we're covering, and I'm going blind through these Woody Allen movies.
Okay.
So I can tell you right now that this is going to be a theme that Spike Lee hones a little tighter, but this to me, the cancer thing is very reflective of Mookie throwing the trash can through the window.
Yeah.
It's the point you didn't expect the movie to get to, but it's the logical next step. Where if you go, well, where's the movie go after that other than end? That feels like in a film where you're talking about a child and the film goes through painstaking lengths to go, this is the authority figure. This is the parent that can't do it. And this is the parent that could do it with her fucking hands tied behind her back.
That refuses to not
right,
do it.
Exactly.
That just doesn't know how to not do it.
You have this idea that the kid, basically, as long as that mother is in her life, she will grow up. You've seen with Do the Right Thing, you've seen the streets of Brooklyn, right? That's not a place where a kid should grow up. It's a place where a kid can play.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you see what is essentially the protector of that character weaken and eventually disappear, then you're stuck going, oh my God, what is gonna happen? And that to me is when you really see kind of the statement about New York, Brooklyn specifically, through the Spike Lee movie, is he's going, yeah, I mean, it seems like everything's kind of working out here, and you know, Brooklyn isn't ideal, but it's still a place you can live. But I think it's showing the frailty of that kind of neighborhood, that community, that all it takes is the strongest member of that community to fail,
right,
or disappear. I shouldn't say fail, that's completely wrong. But all it takes is, you know, cancer or a car accident or an assassination, and suddenly your community that had so much basis and direction turns into chaos and loses a lot of its direction, and it has to fall back on the people who have just had to assume the leadership roles, even though they're not cut out for them.
As for a character arc, it lets her spread her wings. Mm-hmm. She's no longer constrained. Not to say that her mom was ever a burden, but looking at the development of that character, she could never outshine what her mother was able to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
And then giving her that push of her mom not being there and forcing her to step into that role pushes that development forward and capitalizes on all that time she spent down south and growing separate from the boys and learning to take on a different role in that family.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think it is interesting to contrast that to the Woody Allen view of New York, which is don't panic. You live in LA. You're surrounded by restaurants and traffic and people. You can't just disappear.
Right.
Much, much different than someone who really shouldn't have to grow up mm-hmm. on these streets.
Right.
I think both of these directors love the city.
Yeah.
But for one, the city is their lifeblood. And for the other, the city can be an oppressive force.
Sure.
And we'll have to look at that next time, but we do have some executive producers I wanted to thank. Those fine folks include Liam Duffy, Greg Winner, Seth Hanasek, and of course, Matthew Berry. Our website is doublefeatureshow.com and our email address is doublefeatureshow@icloud.com. And the two movies we're doing next time, do you happen to know what they are?
I do. Those next time movies are 13th Floor and Looper.
In, once again, the opposite order.
Whatever.
We just do everything backwards on this show.
I try to do it one way. You try to do it the other way. It's a give, it's a take. You know, that's kind of how we do it.
Are we done with this yet?
You're the Woody Allen to my Spike Lee.
Can we please leave? I want to end this show.
Watch my fucking film.
Bye.